This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Paul Gioni is the co-author of Half the Perfect World, joins us on the program this morning. Hello, Paul.
Good morning, Trevor.
Firstly, Paul, what was the relationship? Did they have a relationship with Leonard Cohen?
Quite a close relationship. They'd been on the island for several years before Cohen turned up. He arrived in 1960 and they'd been there since the mid-50s. Cohen just turned up by himself, didn't know anybody else on the island, and he seems to have met Johnson and Clift almost as soon as he did arrive. They were very good at picking incoming international visitors to the island and trying to find the ones who were kind of interesting that they could draw into their web of friends they had there on the island. They met Cohen almost immediately that he arrived, and they put him up in their house for several nights. Seems he stayed there for a week or two, and then eventually found a place of his own to stay, and they helped him with some furniture and sent him on his way. But they stayed very good friends with Cohen throughout the time that they stayed on the island for the next 4 or 5 years.
Was it a bit of a cool place to go, Hydra, at that time?
Yeah, it certainly had become so. When Johnson and Clift turned up there, they were virtually the only foreign people on the island. There was a very, very small foreign community at that stage. But they established themselves there. They bought a house, and eventually other people began to drift towards the island. And they built this kind of small international community of writers and artists around them, which eventually became quite renowned throughout the Aegean and Mediterranean region. So young writers, artists, intellectuals looking for somewhere away from the cities of Europe, or in the case of Johnson and Clift from Australia, soon heard about this colony and started to gravitate towards it. So Cohen was just one of a number of, or many young people of his age and type, who found themselves drawn to Aedra and falling within the orbit of Johnson and Clift.
So it is pronounced Aedra. Someone just sent me a text to say that it's pronounced Aedra.
The Greeks would say something like Aedra, usually pronounced Aedra, but often pronounced as Hydra as well.
No, I'll have a crack at Aedra because it sounds like the right thing to do. Paul, what drew them to the island?
Johnson and Clift, well, they left Australia like so many artists and intellectuals did at that time in the post-war years, because they found it a little bit too conservative, a little bit too far from the main intellectual centres of the world, and they wanted to be at the heart of the Anglosphere. So they went off to London, and Johnson got a job there as a senior journalist on Fleet Street, and that was in 1951 when they left Australia. But after about 3 or 4 years in London, which they originally found, a very exciting place to be, it suddenly began to kind of pall on them a little bit, that the weather was foul, and they found themselves frustrated, I think, by the fact that they wanted to write, but they couldn't find the time to do so because Johnson had a very busy job. And eventually they realised that if they were going to dedicate their lives to writing, and Clift was equally as keen to become a writer as Johnson, that they would have to get away from London, and they would have to get away from a city, which means they needed somewhere cheap to live, and they wanted to go somewhere in the sunshine. They didn't want to go back to Australia at that time. So they found themselves looking for places in the Mediterranean. And originally they went to another island called Kalymnos, which is another Greek island, and they stayed there for about 12 months. But Kalymnos was a bit far from Athens, and when Clift found that she was pregnant and they needed to be close to Athens, they needed an island that was a bit closer to the Greek mainland. So they found Aedra, and they went there.
See, we recognise the Greek islands now associated so strongly with tourism, and there's a lot of people that travel to the Greek islands. Was it like that then?
No, it's very, very different. Greece had been very slow to emerge from the Second World War, and then had a protracted civil war which ran up from until about 1949. And so recovery and modernisation was much slower in Greece than it was in most of Europe. And during the years of the civil war, post the Second World War, a lot of young Greeks were leaving the country and going elsewhere to look for opportunity. Of course, many of those came to Australia. But the Greek government was keen to rebuild tourism because that was its major industry that they could use as kind of a lever for modernisation. So at the same time that Johnson and Clift went to Aedra, there was very little tourism, but it began to build quite quickly during the mid to late 50s and into the 60s. And so Aedra changed quite a bit in the decade that they were there, from a place which was really a very small, quiet, economically deprived backwater, into somewhere that became kind of a focal point for international tourism.
It's interesting because when you take a look at Australian writers and intellects and performers, London was huge, probably around the 60s and 70s as well. So were they at the forefront of that movement of people who were wanting to be involved in the arts and a sort of a culture? Were they at the forefront of this?
Yeah, well, they were certainly part of that generation of Australians who left to go to London at that period. You know, we know most of the, you know, that sort of drift towards London was almost irresistible to certain types of Australians at that point in time. But whereas most others would stay there or eventually return to Australia or come back and forth between London and Australia, Johnson and Clift moved to the Greek islands. And sadly for them, they were a little bit stranded once they got there because they were very short of money. They invested what money they did have to buy a fairly large house when they got on to Edra. And then they had a third child soon after they arrived. So with three children and a large house to keep and maintain and with very little income because they were struggling to sell the writing at that time, they found they were sort of stuck there. So whereas somebody like Leonard Cohen could come and go, and he would do, because he had an independent income, he was kind of an upper-middle-class family, he had grants from the Canadian government. Sadly for Johnson and Clift, they had none of that kind of revenue flow that allowed them to get on and off the island. So where obviously it was a very attractive place to be, it also, they found themselves marooned there to a certain extent.
How did they meet? Because there's an interesting story about that around the Second World War.
Yes, they met during the Second World War. Johnson was Australia's first appointed war correspondent, and he spent most of his war years in Asia and the Pacific, a lot of the time in China, covering the Chinese-Japanese War. So he was sort of operating in one of the lesser-known theatres of the Second World War. But he established quite a reputation as a major war correspondent. He came back to Australia on leave in 1944, which is when he and Clift met. At that stage, Johnson was already married and had a daughter. And soon after the war, he took up a job in the Argus in Melbourne, and Clift, who he'd already met the previous year, found a job there as well. So they met and had an office romance, which broke up his marriage and led to them leaving Melbourne and going to Sydney. Such was the kind of, you know, notoriety of this young, handsome, globe-trotting war correspondent taking up with the office beauty and breaking up his marriage as a result.
So what was Charmaine's Clift, what was her work life like? What was she doing at the time?
At the time they met, she'd served in the forces during the Second World War, but she's very keen to be a writer, I think she and Johnson were immediately drawn to each other by their kind of shared enthusiasm for having careers as fiction writers. And initially they started writing, co-authoring novels. They co-authored three novels together before Clift began to find that a little bit too limiting and began to kind of push out to try and find a sort of an independent writerly voice. But she was struggling because they did have two children by the time they left Australia, and as I said, they had a third soon after on Edra. So she was kind of bound to the house, and I think she found that very frustrating too. She was a woman who wanted to find her own way through life, and she had quite a libertine attitude towards living. And I think that's why, you know, the Greek islands again appealed to them, because it was somewhere they could go where they wouldn't feel there were too many people looking over their shoulders. They could escape the kind of notoriety of their own relationship in Australia and settle somewhere where, to some extent, you know, they were largely anonymous.
So they were well enough recognised in Australia for that to be an issue for them and a reason to leave.
Yeah, I don't think it was the primary reason to leave, but I certainly felt that they felt they had to leave Melbourne for that reason. I think Johnson felt he'd made himself unemployable in Melbourne, and they moved to Sydney for about 2 or 3 years before they finally left Australia. And they found Sydney a little bit more welcoming to them, I think.
Paul Giannone is the co-author of Half the Perfect World, which is from a Leonard Cohen song, Paul.
Yes, the title's taken from a Leonard Cohen song. It's not a song that he ever recorded. He wrote it for his then-partner, Anjani Thomas, and she recorded it and had it on an album. But it's basically the song about his life on Edra with Marion Island, the woman he met and lived there with there for 10 years. And he uses the phrase half the perfect world to describe kind of living on the island. And we found it an attractive phrase because it kind of sums up what what the island offered, in that it offered what seemingly was a perfect world, you know, this bucolic existence that was cheap, that was in the sunshine, that was free of other responsibilities. But as with so many islands, there were also drawbacks. It was kind of insular, it was isolated at times, it was very kind of cold and lonely existence during winter. And it was economically challenging for Johnson and Clift, as I've already mentioned. So it was gave them half of what they wanted, but not quite all of what they needed.
Bruce gave us a call because he just wanted to talk about Edra. Hello, Bruce.
Yeah, g'day. Look, my father, Harold Brockoff, was a great mate of Barney Connolly, who was a retired Australian ambassador, and he lived on Edra. But he was famous for one thing. He used to take his donkey and his dinghy, and on one occasion he took me across to another island where we were doing some... Greek dancing, and I think we broke at least 200 or 300 plates.
So what did you think about the islands? What era was this? What year was it, Bruce?
God, I'm 76. Probably about 40 years ago. I first went to Greece to spend 3 days there, and I got on a ferry, and 6.5 weeks later I left.
It sounds like one of those places, Paul.
Yeah, that's a very common story. People who went to Edra or to other Greek islands just for a very short period and somehow just found themselves staying. And, you know, Leonard Cohen was one of those. He had no intention to stay there longer than perhaps a week or several weeks, but he found himself spending a summer there, and by the end of that summer he'd bought a house there, and he's found that he's lived there on and off for the next decade of his life, and his family still own that house today. So that's a fairly common story.
Paul, was it a productive place for them to work?
Yes and no, I guess, is the answer to that. They were very hard workers. They had a really strong work ethic, and they managed to overcome the many distractions of living on a Greek island and the kind of sociability that went with that, and maintain a fairly brutal regime of writing. But it was also a debilitating place to some extent as well, because of the fact that it was so sociable. And Johnson and Clift were both given to drinking, and they both took quite responsibly their position as kind of the senior international visitors to the island. And they would, as they did with Cohen, they would take people in, they would help them out, they would lend them materials, they would find housing for them, they would help them to find small bits of employment, they would do whatever they could to support other people. So they found that increasingly kind of onerous over the years. So although they both worked there, they both achieved a lot there. They wrote about a dozen books between them while they were on the island, so it was productive to that extent. But it was also it also wore them out in the end, I think, and certainly the increasing dependence on alcohol that they both had was a huge problem for them.
So did it become a bit of a party island in itself? When you take a look at the photos throughout your book and the people that were there, there was quite a strong community, and everyone was having a pretty good time.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what drew a lot of people there. They didn't really go there necessarily to write or to paint. A lot of them just went there for the party life, and and Johnson and Clift found it hard not to be drawn into that. So there was this kind of constant tension, as far as they were concerned, between their commitment to their writing, which they maintained and never lost, but also the irresistible urge to go and sit down by the dockside and drink cheap ouzo and wine during the afternoon and just talk to your mates. And they were an interesting group of people to talk to as well. Who of us wouldn't like the chance to sit around the table and talk to Leonard Cohen and others of his ilk?
Irresistible. It sounds like that whole university thing that was happening around that time in Australia and also in London. It was just moved to a different to an island.
Yeah, that was pretty moment. Given that, as I said earlier, when Johnson and Clift went there, they were almost the only international visitors. Within 4 to 5 years, they had this large circle of international people of a young age. You know, Johnson and Clift were older. Johnson was, by this stage, in his mid-40s, and Clift in his mid-30s, but most of these people were younger than that. They were in their sort of 20s. You know, some of the Australians who turned up, they're like young Mungo McCallum, a political journalist, spent quite a bit of time living with Clift and Johnson, and when he was in his 20s, and Rodney Hall, the Australian novelist, was in his 20s when he turned up on the island as well, and also became very close with Johnson and Clift. So there was a lot of people in that kind of just post-university, or not necessarily they all went to university, but they found themselves experiencing kind of a university of life by being on this island.
Jan joins us. Hello, Jan.
Yes, g'day. My aunt and uncle moved in the same circles as Charmian and George Johnson and knew them. Now, I want to ask the author, did they come back to Australia? Because I recall in the 1960s, it was either when their books were becoming popular or they came back for some reason. My parents were very conservative and extremely judgmental. My mother was extremely dismissive about Charmian Clift. And I remember Dad being very judgmental, like, regarded him as a reprobate. But my aunt and uncle had a completely different attitude towards them. So I'm wondering why I was so aware of those attitudes.
Very good question, Jan. They did come back to Australia. They came back in 1964. Johnson published the novel for which he became very famous, My Brother Jack, and came back to Australia for the launch of the novel. And by that stage, he was getting quite homesick, although Clift wanted to stay on in Edra. She came back in 1964 also, but she stayed until about 6 or 7 months later before she returned with the children. And Johnson came back something of a national hero because he just published this big novel that had been so well received in the United Kingdom and also became a major novel in Australia. Clift then found herself a position writing for the Sydney Morning Herald, a weekly article which became in itself a very high-profile piece of writing. She became a major social and political commentator through this page in the women's pages that she had in on a weekly basis. I think the reason they were so notorious at this stage is because Clift had engaged in a number of extramarital relationships on Edra, and some news and stories about this began to leak back to Australia. So although they came back with their marriage intact, they'd had a very kind of disruptive personal life while they were on the island because of Clift's infidelities. And certainly people in Australia knew about that. And so she was considered at the time to be something of a scarlet woman almost.
Floozy.
Exactly.
So what did they... I didn't realise they had gossip magazines in the 50s and 60s that would be bringing information all the way from Greece to Australia.
Well, it was mainly Australians bringing information from Greece to Australia because... So Johnson and Clift mixed with a lot of people who were transient on the island. Many of them were Australians who then returned to Australia and knew exactly what was going on. They knew that Johnson and Clift were both drinking heavily, and they knew that they'd become very argumentative. Their relationship was quite strained during this period. And so those stories found their way back to Australia. They also maintained a presence here because there were a number of articles written about them and the life they were living on Edra that found their way into the Australian press. And it may not have been the gossip press as we now know it, but the Australian Women's Weekly, for example, ran a number of articles about them over those years, kind of on one hand extolling the Mediterranean lifestyle that they were living and making it look like it was kind of a very glamorous life, which it both was and wasn't. But because of that, you know, people still who knew who they were, still some of them were reading the books they were publishing, and they were kind of, there was this kind of low-level gossip that was certainly heard in Australia.
Was there any mixing or correlation between them and the Sydney push that was happening between the 40s and 70s? Because it's around their time in the same group of people.
Yeah, good question, Trevor. The answer is not really. The push were younger and they were university educated and they all came through the University of Sydney primarily. And they were kind of the bohemians of a younger generation. Whereas Johnson and Clift were older, and I think they treated university educated people with some suspicion because neither of them had had a university education. And, you know, they were great believers in the university of life as where you kind of acquired your mature self rather than going through a university education. But as I said, Mungo McCallum, now he was kind of a product of the push generation and the University of Sydney, and he went and spent time with them. But he fell in with Johnson and Clift mainly because Mungo McCallum Sr., his father, was a friend of Johnson's. So there was kind of a generational link there between the McCallum family and Johnsons rather than with younger Mungo. But of course they welcome younger Mungo to their and his wife and child and into Edra, and they certainly were very friendly and supportive of him, and he remembered them with great fondness because they were, you know, they were a very charismatic couple. The fact that they would put themselves out there, they were both very garrulous, they were both, you know, highly sociable, and, you know, people enjoyed their company.
You talked about the people that were transient or came to and fro when they were there for a significant period of time. Were there other writers or artists that stayed for as long as they did, as far as that community is concerned?
Yes, there were others who bought houses and stayed on the island for extended periods. And, you know, said Leonard Cohen bought a house there. Perhaps one of the best-known Australians who spent a considerable amount of time there was Sidney Nolan, who was a friend of Johnson's from London. They'd met and befriended in London. And when Johnson and Clift arrived on Edra, they invited Nolan to come and join them. And he found a house on the island and lived there for about 7 or 8 months. And that was when he started painting his very famous Gallipoli series of paintings. He took advantage of the fact that Gallipoli and the Turkish coast were quite close and he could visit from Edra, and started to work on this very significant body of art that kind of preoccupied him for the next 20 years of his life.
How significant was the time that that Johnson spent as a war correspondent to his work?
It was extremely important to him. He learned how to write very quickly and under great pressure, working as a war correspondent, and even as a correspondent, he was admired by other correspondents and journalists for his ability to work under pressure and to churn material out at a great pace, and that's a skill that he never lost. He could always write with great fluency and very quickly, and to some extent that dogged him a little bit in trying to write fiction, because he always wrote quickly, and he perhaps to his own detriment. But he never kind of lost that ability to work hard and to put aside other distractions in his life and to commit himself to his writing. It was only when he got to writing My Brother Jack, you know, the novel that made his reputation in Australia, that he kind of slowed down a bit and took a bit more time, and he realised that this was going to be his great novel. Because interestingly, although he'd written some 12 or 13 novels before My Brother Jack, it was the first to be set in Australia. He'd always set his novels outside Australia, in Europe and in Asia. But it was the first time that he ever started to write about his homeland. And as I said earlier, it was the novel that eventually brought him home as well, when he had to come home to kind of participate in the launch of the novel.
Well, because you mentioned how Charmian Clift and George Johnson wrote together, and they write several novels together, but he wanted to do his own thing and to separate. How did she feel about that?
Well, I think it was more she who wanted to separate, actually, Trevor. I think she felt that Johnson kind of dominated their writing when they did it in tandem, and she wanted to kind of establish her own voice as a writer. And she did that originally not by publishing fiction. Her first two books that she wrote were actually about, they were travel memoirs about living on the Greek island. She wrote one called Mermaid Singing, which was about the 12 months they spent on Kalymnos, and then she wrote another one called Peel Me a Lotus, which is probably her best-known book that she wrote about the time on Edra. So she was actually recording and reporting on life on Edra as they were living it. And for anybody who wants to know something about living on Edra in the 1950s, her novel or her book, Peel Me a Lotus, is the starting point, because it writes about the community that was evolving around them as it was happening, and the way the island was beginning to change. Even in the first 12 or 18 months they were there, they noticed the changes that were beginning to take place on the island as tourism became ever more a part of the, you know, the life of the island.
How did she feel about that? Did they feel that they'd lost a paradise to other people?
Yeah, she was very ambivalent about it. I mean, on one hand, it gave them what they wanted, which was people to talk to, because they had very few people to talk to because they couldn't speak Greek. And so, you know, they found themselves quite isolated there to some extent, and particularly over winter when, you know, the few English speakers who did drift through disappeared, because the winters there could be quite harsh. So it bought them something they needed. But she saw that the island was going to change, and change rapidly. And there was a sort of a tipping point only about 12 months after they arrived, when Hollywood turned up on the island. They made a film called Boy and a Dolphin, starring Alan Ladd and Sophia Loren. It was the first time the Hollywood cameras, you know, Technicolor big screen, had ever gone to film in Greece, and the film was set on Edra. And when that hit the cinemas in the United States, a lot of American tourists thought, I want to go there because it's a very beautiful place. It looks spectacular on the big screen. And suddenly people started to come to the island in very large numbers over the summer months. And that was certainly unexpected to them and something they found, quite threatening to the sort of lifestyle they'd actually gone there to establish.
No wonder. I've seen that film. It's a terrific film. And there's no wonder people would have gone to go there. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it is a very beautiful place. And another thing it has about it, and I think it probably attracted the filmmakers of Boy and a Dolphin, there is no traffic on the island. It's one of the only occupied Greek island that has no traffic. One of your callers earlier mentioned donkeys, and donkeys and mules are the only form of transport on the island. So as soon as you go there, you're kind of caught up in the atmospherics of a place which is so unlike, you know, the modern city, because there's no engine sounds, there's no that noise that comes with traffic. There aren't even any bicycles really on the island. So it's almost a wheel-free existence, and it makes it a very, very beautiful place to go to.
You mentioned that it was my brother Jack that brought Johnson back to Australia after winning the Miles Franklin. Was it before or after winning the Miles Franklin?
He returned to Australia before it won the Miles Franklin. It was awarded the Miles Franklin in 1965 for the best book published in 1964.
If that was the case, was that the primary reason, or they had enough of the island as well?
I think George had enough of the island. I think he, in particular, I think Cliff would have stayed there longer, and she was reluctant to leave. But eventually she decided she had to join George back in Australia. So I said she'd stay some 6 or 7 months longer before she brought the children back. But I think for Johnson, he just felt that what they'd gone there for had reached a stage where it could never be retrieved. In other words, over that course of that decade, the island had changed so much. But he was missing Australia too. He was quite homesick for Australia. And he wrote about that at the time, about just this need to return.
When they did return, did they both continue having strong careers from there?
Well, Johnson was very sick by the time he got back to Australia. Oh. He contracted tuberculosis, and he didn't help himself by continuing to smoke and drink heavily against doctor's orders. And I think he, in a sense, he knew he was coming back to Australia to die. And it was very clear when he returned, he was only in his early 50s, but it was pretty clear that he didn't have a long life ahead of him. So he lived another 6 years, but he did spend a lot of that time being very unwell and had some extensive periods of hospitalisation. But again, he kept writing. He never gave up his writing. And, you know, My Brother Jack was the big autobiographical novel of his own life, and he wrote a trilogy, usually referred to as the David Meredith trilogy, because David Meredith's the main character in the three books, which basically told the three phases of his life. The first phase in My Brother Jack was his life up to the point where he expatriated and went overseas. There was a second novel called Clean Straw for Nothing, where he wrote about his years of expatriation, living in London and in the Greek islands. And the third was a book called Cartload of Clay, which dealt with his return to Australia after his expatriation. So it's kind of a cycle of three novels which tells the story of his life.
But the second
so he remained a very busy.
So with the second two novels, well, not as successful, but successful?
The second one, Clean Straw for Nothing, also won the Miles Franklin Award. And I think a lot of people would consider it to be the equal to My Brother Jack. It probably didn't have the same kind of impact as the first novel, as second novels really do in sequences. But it was certainly a very, very fine novel. The third one, Cartload of Clay, was never finished. Although he was writing in the novel about his return to Australia and his own death, which he knew was imminent, he actually died before it was completed, but it was published in an unfinished state. But no, they're three very fine books, and the whole trilogy, I think, is a major achievement of mid-20th century Australian fiction.
Charmian Clift is also recognised for her essays that she wrote in the probably mid-60s. Why were they significant?
Yeah, these were the essays that were originally published in the Sydney Morning Herald and widely syndicated around Australia. They were significant because although she was using the women's pages, she did something quite new in the women's pages. It wasn't about recipes and it wasn't about domestic life. She wrote as a woman with considerable experience of living outside Australia, and she reflected on that constantly. and the way in which Australia was changing and developing. And she was quite engaged with some political issues, like she was very strongly opposed to the Vietnam War, and she took strong stances on issues like that. And she began, for a lot of women in Australia, she began to show them a picture into another world, a much more cosmopolitan existence, and much an existence where Australia looked outward to the rest of the world. It was kind of that part of that big push in Australia during the 60s to move away from what we now loosely remember as the Menzies era into something new, I guess into the Whitlam years. And she was kind of a transitional voice that helped kind of ease that arc or that change in people's lives as they moved from the post-war conservative into a view of Australia as a much more integrated, a much more outward-looking and a much more culturally developed nation.
That's quite a big thing to do for that time, because although we talk about the swinging 60s, the 60s in Australia was really still quite conservative. So for somebody to be doing that would have copped a little bit of pushback as well.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't always well received, and some of it became, you know, quite controversial. But she built up a very large and loyal readership, and although she was writing in the women's page, a lot of men began to read her as well. For a lot of men, it was probably, you know, the first time they dipped into those sections of the newspapers, which thankfully we don't have anymore, which were kind of, you know, labelled the women's section, and that's where she found her voice and wrote so effectively and so powerfully. And those essays, most of them have now been collected into various volumes and can still be bought, but they still have an audience today. People still read them for the, you know, the clarity of the writing. She was an extremely fine writer as well, certainly the equal of George Johnson, and she kind of found her, although she published several other novels and the travel memoirs that I referred to earlier, she really did find her feet once she started writing with the Sydney Morning Herald.
Do you know if she was satisfied with that and it was being a novelist that was her preference, or was she comfortable being an essayist?
Yeah, that's a good question, Trevor. No, she always had in mind she wanted to write fiction. That was her primary goal as a writer, and I think she originally took on the role writing the essays simply as a way of you know, earning a bit of money and getting herself re-established in Australia, but she had a long-term project of writing her own big autobiographical novel, and she'd really worked on it for 7 or 8 years prior to her death, and she struggled with it for various reasons. She did kind of hit a case, I guess, of what we loosely call writer's block with that particular work, and that frustrated her. And I think she felt there was always this underlying competitiveness with Johnson, although they kind of helped each other always with their writing, they also kind of competed. And I think she felt that she had, in a sense, been beaten by Johnson, the fact that he managed to write his big autobiographical book and to make himself a well-known author in Australia. And she perhaps felt that she just wasn't making the same headway. And although she kind of enjoyed the success that came with her career as a journalist, it really wasn't her number one priority.
Did she outlive him, or was it vice versa?
No, he outlived her. Cliff took her own life in 69, and almost exactly 12 months before Johnson passed away from his illness. So, you know, we can, as with all suicides, there's always question marks about the exact reason why people take that step. But I think some of her frustrations with her writing were probably part of the reason anyway.
Were they together? Did their relationship last?
Yes, they were together. They were kind of absolutely joined at the hip, although, you know, it had been a difficult marriage and it was very combative, kind of two very intense personalities who spent so much time in each other's company, because, you know, on Idra there was no escaping each other, and I think it was much the same in Australia too, because, you know, they were both working in the house as writers. They did stay together, I think they would have stayed together too, although their friends were constantly expecting them to break up. It probably would never have got to that point. Despite the stress on the marriage, it did seem to survive and be robust at another level.
Well, Avon News is coming up very soon. What about their children?
They had three children. They had an oldest boy, Martin, who went on to become a very fine poet, probably one of the leading poets of his generation in Australia. But he died a fairly early death from alcohol-related issues. Daughter, Shane, she also sadly committed suicide in her mid-20s. And they have a youngest son, Jason, who's still alive and still with us.
Paul, it's a fascinating story, a wonderful book as well. Thank you very much for telling us a little bit about it today.
Pleasure, Trevor. Lovely to talk to you.
Paul Giannone.
Thanks for your interest.
Who joined us this morning to take a look at their lives in a book that's called Half the Perfect World, which takes a look at their lives on Idra and the other people that were on Idra as well. This is Overnights.